If you'll remain standing for the reading of these verses from which Michael will preach tonight in Colossians 3. Put on then as God's chosen ones, holy and beloved, compassionate hearts, kindness, humility, meekness, and patience, bearing with one another. And if one has a complaint against another, forgiving each other. As the Lord has forgiven you, so you also must forgive. And above all these, put on love, which binds everything together in perfect harmony. And let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, to which indeed you were called in one body, and be thankful.
Well, I invite you to turn to Colossians chapter 3, the passage that Claude read a few minutes ago. Our evening series presently is a series on love does, and then we're to supply a verb. Love does what? It does this and that. And I think the title is Accentuates the Good or something like that, but it basically sums up these few verses in Colossians 3. He's done some negative exhortations, and now, verse 12, he begins positive virtues for the Christian to have. I think I've used this before, but you're like, as I am, you tend to forget, so I'll say it again. In the year 197, there was a Christian living in North Africa who was a trained lawyer, and after his conversion in his adult years, he began to write in defense of Christianity. He would write the emperor. And on one of those occasions, he wrote the emperor defending Christians. And it was just a couple of years before that emperor would actually decree laws against conversions, against Christian conversions, against even Jewish conversions. And if you were caught promoting that or having participated in that, the punishments were severe, even death. And that's the kind of situation some of our brothers and sisters live in around the world. Well, this is an old technique of evil. And it was even there in the second century. So this man, Tertullian, wrote, and just quote a part of what he says in defense of Christianity. He says, it is our care for the helpless, our practice of loving kindness that brands us in the eyes of many of our opponents. Look, they say with disgust, look at how they love one another. What an accusation. but that was the accusation. And Tertullian included that in his defense of Christians and the gospel. Look at how they love one another. No doubt said with scorn. Paul has been writing to the Colossian Christians. And it's much the setup of the book of Romans, as Claude has brought out over our studies there. A lot of indicatives or declarative statements about who we are, okay, who we are in Christ. Second half of the book, imperatives, therefore this is how you live, okay? Who we are, whose we are, comes as the foundation upon which the exhortations come. Therefore walk. Therefore live. Therefore, this is the lifestyle of a Christian. But the imperatives are based upon the indicatives of who we are in Jesus. Our identity is the foundation. And Paul does the same thing here. By way of an outline, just briefly, 3 points. We have his exhortation in the first part of verse 12. That's followed by the basis of the exhortation in the second place. And in the third place, we just have a list of things. He's given us 2 lists of negative things, and this is the positive list that follows. All right. Well, first of all, our exhortation there in verse 12, put on then. And this is clothing language. We've seen that elsewhere in other studies. He talks about put on and put off. It's a clothing imagery, almost like a uniform. You're getting ready to go to school. You put on this uniform. If you're a policeman or a soldier or someone in the Navy or the Air Force, you put on the uniform. That's your job. It's indicative of the job you have. So he's saying, put on these clothes. All right. This is very old language in the ancient Near East. Ran across an example dated back to about 1200 B.C. in a city just north of Jerusalem, some miles, Ugarit. The excavations there have found entire libraries and temples full of scrolls. It's just been amazing. But in one of the findings there at Ugarit, there's the story of a king who was divorcing his wife, the queen. He made a provision for his son, the one son they had between them, the crown prince. Okay? The son could go with his mother if he wanted. He was free to do that. But if he did, he must leave his clothes on the throne. You see, the kingship would not pass to the son if the son decided to go with his mother. And so he had to give up the clothes indicative of the position, leave them on the throne. Okay? That's more of a put off here instead of the put on, like Paul is telling us. But I hope you get the idea, just the importance of clothing and the imagery here. Now, Paul is telling us to put on then. That's our exhortation. Now, what's the basis of it? Secondly, the basis upon which he tells us to put on these virtues that follow. What do you think? What would be the basis upon which he would tell us to put on the clothing of a Christian? Notice in verse 12. Put on then as God's chosen ones, could be elect ones, holy and beloved. The language here is of an actual characteristic quality about those Christians there. It's not something to which they aspire, not something they hope at a higher level of spirituality they will attain. They already have it. They are God's chosen ones. They are holy. They are beloved. It's not a future reference that it may come in the hereafter. It is present. It is an actual characteristic, quality that they have now. That's who they are. Paul appeals to their identity in Christ as the basis upon which he exhorts them. And he uses Old Testament language of Israel. They were the chosen of God. They were holy. They were beloved. And now Paul, the former Pharisee, has no trouble using this very language to apply it to the church and believers in the New Testament. He doesn't say if you try hard enough. He doesn't say if you memorize all those verses, maybe. He doesn't say if you have your perfect attendance. And on we could go. We think we must do something to earn it. Works is just deep in our hearts. And I wonder sometimes if it will just keep coming out until the time we stand before the throne of God. And there we'll be utterly convinced we're not there because of works. Not ours, but the works of Jesus on our behalf. Well, our exhortation put on then the basis, our new identity. God's elect ones, His chosen ones, holy, beloved ones. Okay? So notice with me, thirdly, the list. We've had our exhortation, our basis, now the list. And he's already given two lists of vices, each one enumerating five vices. There in verse 5, you have sexual immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, covetousness, which is idolatry. The second list vice is in verse 8. Put them all away, anger, wrath, malice, slander, obscene talk. So we have two vice lists of five each. Put them off. Now's the good stuff. Put this stuff on, okay, as God's beloved ones. Compassionate hearts, kindness, humility, meekness, and patience, bearing with one another. And if one has a complaint against another, forgiving each other, as the Lord has forgiven you, so you also must forgive. And above all these things, that love which binds together everything together in perfect harmony. Well, let's just look at this briefly. I don't want to comment on all of them, just a few of them in the interest of time. But he begins with compassionate hearts. He's not telling us an outward duty to do, is he? He doesn't do that. Compassionate hearts. The King James, this is the language in the original is that which you feel very deeply. Some might even say you just feel it in your gut. The King James, though it's archaic at this point, captures it well. Put on the bowels of mercy. The old language. Put that on as one who is beloved, as one who is chosen, as one who is holy. This is an important word for Jesus in some of his parables, because that attitude reflects the very turning point in three of his major parables. For instance, Matthew 18, the unmerciful slave. The turning point of that story is where one has a compassionate heart. In Luke chapter 10, the parable of the Good Samaritan, the entire story hinges on the compassionate heart of one person. And he's in contrast to some others that don't have it. But one had compassion, a compassionate heart, and stopped and helped the man who had been beaten and robbed. The third parable where Jesus uses this at the turning point of the story is the prodigal son. Luke 15, we're familiar with it. And no doubt for Jesus' audience, they would be wondering, once the son decided to leave the pigsties and go home, how would he be received by his father? What would be the father's attitude? And this word is used of the father's attitude when he sees his son. You get the picture that his son just had not been home for a very long time. But every day he was away, his father was looking, wanting him to return. And then that day comes, and it's like, I don't know, maybe it wasn't actually how it happened in Jesus' mind, but I picture it as on the horizon, there's a small figure, dust coming up from him trudging on the dusty road. I'm immediately identified by his father, and he is moved with compassion, and he runs. He doesn't wait for the son to come up to on the porch and give a speech. No, the father runs to him. He was moved with compassion. Compassionate hearts. We're to put that on, first of all, as God's chosen ones, holy and beloved. He then mentions kindness, humility, meekness, patience. And then after these couple of words, we have verse 13, bearing with one another, forgiving each other. And the structure here is the means through which the preceding virtues are to be practiced. How do we practice them? We bear with each other. This is the church, y'all. Yeah, we bear with each other. That's a way of showing a compassionate heart, kindness, humility, and meekness. We forgive each other. That is a means by which we have compassionate hearts, are meek, humble, patient, and so forth. That's the structure here. The language there, forgiving each other, it's a different word than is usually used in the New Testament. The usual word means to release from debt, to release from indebtedness. That's not the word here. The idea here is to forgive freely, unconditionally, no qualms about it, to be unceasing in our forgiveness, to be unwearyingly forgiving. And notice he qualifies this as the Lord has forgiven you. So you must forgive each other. Paul insists on the connection, you see, between our practice of forgiveness to reflect the forgiveness we have received freely, unconditionally from the Lord Himself. Our forgiveness is to reflect that. We have been the objects of His forgiveness. And in the church, as a means of expressing compassionate hearts, meekness, humility, so forth, we're to forgive. It's the church. We're to practice these things. And then finally, he points to the supreme importance of love. And above all, he says, above all, put on love, which binds everything together in perfect harmony. So it's like he elevates this virtue above the rest. The supremacy of love here, above all these others, put on love. And then he qualifies it. It's what binds people, everything together. And the language here, it binds together, is actually a surgical term, ligament. How about that? Love is a ligament. It holds things together. It holds joints in place so that they work well. One person said the church is to be like, have a phalanx of love. I like that language. The word phalanx is a Greek idea of rows and stacks of men in a military formation. It allowed the battle into which they were marching together. It allowed the battle to be brutal, but not quite as deadly as other means. Actually, you know, we like see military parades and even bands at football games and things. Well, this marching in line, this idea of advancing, retreating, turning on command, the preservation of formation, the mutual protection of rank and file, all comes from this Greek military idea of a phalanx. And y'all, they swept the battlefield with it. They swept it. Alexander the Great, and other their military generals knew how to use it. They were mobile. They had good speed. They had good range. That was fine, but that wasn't the primary use of a phalanx. A phalanx stressed group solidarity and maximum defense of each man within that group. We're protecting each other. We're marching together. You're not out there on your own. It's not safe. Stay in here. Stay behind the shields. Stay behind the spear points. There's safety in solidarity. We're to have the church is to present a phalanx of love to the world. One more example, and we'll head toward the Lord's table. Julian the Apostate was a Roman character and heir to the throne. He was the half-brother of Constantine. He was raised in a Christian home and turned his back on it all, and even turned against the church. So thus his name. You know, so many years later, Julian the Apostate won. On one occasion, he is complaining against what he calls the atheists, the Christians. You know, the Christians did not believe in all the pantheon of Roman gods and would not worship them. So they were regarded by Julian and others as atheists. The irony there. Anyway, on one occasion, Julian was complaining and he said, "Why do we not observe," he's complaining, "that it is their benevolence to strangers, the way they care for their dead, and the pretended holiness that has done the most to increase their atheism?" He says the spread of Christianity is the result of caring for strangers, caring for their dead, and living holy lives. And Julian said it spreads their atheism. Well, may the Lord give us grace to spread the atheism more and more in our day. One way of doing that certainly is here, to put on these things as God's chosen ones, holy and beloved.